Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host. Thanks for tuning in. Wow. So I am privileged today to be joined again by Kim Adele Randall, who everyone probably knows by now, and also Nish Ranasinghe. And we are having a great conversation, hopefully, with Sharina Rice from across the pond. And Sharina Rice is a neuroscientist, a cybernetician, and a storyteller. And she's got a PhD in neuroscience from University of Michigan. She's studying neural circuits and brain rhythms. So that's particularly interesting. And she also served as co-founder and chief scientific officer of INTVO, a computer vision for pedestrian behavior prediction. So that's very interesting. And also scientific advisor of Valence Vibrations, transmitting emotions from the tone of voice as visuals or wristband haptics. So that's very interesting. And yeah, I know you've got an avid interest in meditation as well. And you trained as a Dharma worker in the Buddhist temple. So that's very interesting. So thank you so much for joining us. Really, you know, I'm not sure about kicking off with this one fat question, because you know, it may be just too much of a big question. But no, I think, thank you, first of all, for joining us. The question that I wanted to sort of kick off with was, how do you conceptualize the relation between philosophy, science, and technology?
I think of it this way. It's that philosophy underpins science, and science underpins technology. So then, if you have a shaky philosophical foundation in terms of how you go about finding the truth, then what do you have at the end of the day but hype that is not substantiated by anything real? And it is kind of notable that in society, the way that things are talked about is that technology, it tends to be at the pinnacle of things. If you want to get a good job, then usually a person is pushed into a technology field, partly because it can be patented and sold, unlike scientific laws or about the workings of nature. And then philosophy, is being a philosopher even considered a job these days? And yet, at the same time, there is this matter of how do we take the truths and how do we use them in the best possible ways in application for this to really create great effects for society and for what we can do as humans in expanding potential?
Wow, it's true, isn't it? I mean, they all interlink. And I think, with anything, if our foundations are rocky, then we don't have a lot of hope, do we, for where that's going? And I guess our philosophy grows with us, doesn't it, as we go through life, based on our experiences, the people that we bump into, the opportunities that life offers us, whether they be pleasant or an opportunity to grow, as is often the case. I guess all of that shapes. So would it be right in thinking that whilst it, to your point, it underpins everything, actually both of them are ever moving, and therefore it almost has to loop back round to continue learning? Would that be a fair assumption?
Yeah, in a way, I think of it as upcycling as well, where it's just like, okay, there is an upward spiral. Hegel has talked about this, where there is some sort of thesis, there's an antithesis and a synthesis. So as history progresses, then there continues to be, in a way, disagreements that lead to some sort of insight and progress. And so it's great to see that happening over time.
Yeah, because it's true, isn't it? I mean, we live in a world of polarity. So for every up, there's a down, for every left, there's a right. So I guess as we continue to evolve and have those discussions, have those debates, sometimes have those disagreements, it allows us to start to see things from a slightly different viewpoint. And I guess that's where progress is really made, isn't it? Once we're able to see a new side that can be explored.
Yeah. And one way that I think about this is that often in technology ethics, it's said, oh, artificial intelligence is biased or technology is biased. But the thing is that any system that has a viewpoint at all, it has a bias, because bias is literally, seeing something from an angle. But while people, they would often say that they want to expand their perspective, they would almost never say that they want to expand their bias, which is kind of a funny dichotomy. So then I think of it kind of in terms of, if you have multiple different perspectives and they're integrated into a fuller view of what is, then this can at times help people to solve problems more accurately or more precisely.
Sharina, I mean, everything that you've said, I'm kind of in awe, and I'm sort of sitting there thinking, gosh, I don't, you know, it's difficult to visualize. Or from what I'm thinking is that at the moment, the only application that I can see, or and my meager mind can see, is the application of social media and how that has evolved over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, and evolved from being something that was intentionally sort of had good intentions. But then obviously we know that some of the things I think you're talking about is things like trying to map pedestrian behavior, or what I understand by that is kind of standard human behavior patterns, and therefore grow a presence or grow an application in that way. However, obviously with social media, we're seeing that can have good and bad applications, and it can be taken, be good in a good context, but also quite bad from a psychological, for example, perspective. What can you see as being some of the better applications of modeling those patterns of behavior? And what kind of stuff are you working on to ensure that, you know, the ethics of a system is maintained in a good way, rather than trying to capitalize on something by modeling sort of, you know, gambling or addictive behaviors, for example?
Looking back, there are some things that may have been considered repetitive behaviors that have actually been considered a good thing. So for example, in the temple, we've done chanting and prostrations, which are both repetitive activities. But the point of it partly was that we were not going through the motions, but that we had to be in what we were doing, our mind and our body being connected. So it's not like you could just chant without your heart being in it. Otherwise, the priest would point that out and say, you need to chant and you need to be there and we need to hear you through this. It's not just making sounds. It's not just repeating the same thing over again. And this is notable in a world where user experience research, for instance, it often takes behaviors at a surface level and has this underpinning philosophy of don't make me think to it. So in a world where our products are designed often to have us not think about things, this can help us to reserve some bandwidth for things that are actually important to us. But then there's the question of, are we sacrificing short-term conveniences for long-term lack of mindfulness? Mindfulness is also quite a fuzzy term, because it can be hard to measure things such as, okay, how much are you actually here when you're here? Or how much are you mentally paying attention to things? So the way that I think about this is that in general, if our postures towards technology and creations of technology were to help people to be their best selves, and people demanded that of their technology, and people demanded that of companies that they invested in, then perhaps there could be a better world in terms of technology that truly does serve humanity in the long term.
Very good. Very interesting. Very interesting. So what do you think about this this productivity cycle that we're in at the moment? According to MIT, we're actually in a productivity curve, and we're actually at the beginning of this curve, right? So do you think that people are going to have problems with having too much spare time on their hands and worrying what they're going to do with it?
I think that people, they never have too much spare time on their hands. Well, most of the time they do not, because whenever there is spare time, then it will be filled with something, whether that is spending time with their friends and family. That is usually said to be the best part of the productivity boom. But I think that there is a bigger undertone of culture in terms of people need to work for a certain number of hours a week in order to gain their benefits and to be considered fully employed. So then in that case, I think that people will still end up working about the same amount. There is the question, though, of how much they can create from that time, as well as how whether they go from ideators to actuators, or if they are mostly doing the actuation of tasks. It is good to have humans ultimately make the decisions for what is created rather than completely having that up to a machine. Partly because humans, they tend to be good at analyzing broader situations, including situations that have never happened before. Machine learning, it can only work backwards. So if we're trying to train on things, but historically a similar situation has never happened, or there is somewhat of a monkey wrench that is put into place, a single variable that changes everything, then there is the question of who is accountable at the end of the day, if not a human or a group of humans. And that accountability, I think, is a major matter of why it's important to have humans in the loop.
Fascinating. I could chat to you all day with the whole how all of them link together, isn't it? And how the how it all comes back round to that requirement for us to continue to grow our collective thinking. And I think that is the part, isn't it, that the human brain brings in. It's that ability to be able to have that debate about things that haven't happened but might happen, particularly because there's so many conspiracy theorists out there that love to create something that hasn't happened yet, which obviously machines aren't able to do. And I guess it's how they work in sync together, isn't it, so that they add value rather than detract from anything that's happening organically.
Indeed.
So what do you think is the next trend?
I think the next trend is talking about how Elon Musk is collecting Twitter. It seems to be a very prevalent thing right now. It is all over the news. Aside from that, I cannot really predict.
it's very interesting, isn't it? So, you know, I know it's part of your mission in life to, take away as much suffering as possible and invert it, right, through matters of humans and machines. But do you think that there are too many laggards that are kind of just slowing the whole thing down, and too many people that are just like, just don't want to embrace this new wave of technology?
Human suffering is kind of a fascinating matter, partly because we may want to, say, have a child who never suffers at all and then give them everything that they want, but yet they will still suffer, for instance. So what do we do with that? And what do we do with human nature, which tends to suffer even if we have the best possible conditions in all of human history? I think that it's partly a matter of storytelling, and storytelling in a sense is a technology that humans have used ever since always. I think also that a reason why I use the term invert suffering as much as possible, or take as much suffering and invert it, is because the things that do make us suffer, a lot of them, they will still be there. There will still be conflicts between people in the world. There will still be various strifes and things like inequalities and problems that just arise. But then there's the question of how do we orient ourselves to them? Are we going to continuously dwell on what isn't perfect or things that are upsetting to us? Or are we going to orient towards them differently and possibly be somewhat amused by them? And I tend to find that a better life comes from just being amused by the many things that happen. It's not a story unless something goes wrong. And sometimes things that are terrible, they serve as someone's life guide because they didn't think that anyone else would have that problem. And yet they find you and then they go, wow, this can really help me with whatever I'm doing. So I think that taking whatever does seem to be making us suffer and thinking through it somewhat differently or from another perspective, it can help us to, well, we may still have our sufferings there, but the way that we hold it and the way that it doesn't make us quite as tense, perhaps, it is a more healthy way to be.
I love that. It's so true. Sorry, Nish, I think you're about to say something as well, but it's so true, isn't it? I think, you know, one of the things I've learned in life is that everything is either a lesson, a blessing, or both. Even if it doesn't feel like it at the time, it gives us something that we didn't have before. It allows us to grow. And you come to the other side of it and look back and go, oh, wasn't that bad, really? I survived it. I think sometimes when we do change the label, we change the outcome, don't we? We change the way we view it. We change how it impacts us. And I, whenever anything challenging comes my way, I was just like, shout plot twist and run at it, see what happens next. Because, you know, we are living a life of stories. And I love that you shared that too, is that, you know, we have been using stories since the cavemen drawings, so right back at the very beginning. And it's how we teach and it's how we learn. So I think the ability to be able to use storytelling, and I think having technology help us do that, might help us to stop a lot of the conflict, because conflict usually comes from misunderstanding, misinformation, or miscommunication. So if we can better understand each other, hopefully we can remove some of those and therefore create a nicer environment that replenishes all. Nish, you were going to say something, so I'm going to shut up.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I loved that what you said about it's not a story unless something goes wrong, because it's so true, right? As humans, we spend so much time worrying about things going wrong and thinking that we're wrong because we think a certain way, or someone else is wrong because they think a certain way. And actually, if you embrace imperfection, and if you think about how the whole world in creation is actually one big accident, depending on how you look at it, you know, I'm sure a tree didn't intend to become a tree, or, you know, a flower didn't intend to become a flower, but they both are what they are, and they're both beautiful to everyone. So, you know, it is that idea of collectively accepting each other's imperfections, and also your own imperfections, and realizing that actually you don't have to be perfect. Like, I'm talking in the middle of trying to plan a wedding, and, you know, this weekend trying to reassure people that things do not have to go to plan, because something will go wrong, something will be forgotten, and relieving that kind of, so much of anxiety and stress is down to this notion of being perfect, whether that be a perfect mother, a perfect husband, perfect wife, perfect person. So I love that, the idea of that, you know, and even, you know, in applying that to your job, and working in technology and building software solutions, it's a case of, you know, if something is tested and it goes wrong, this notion that you've failed, the technology has failed because it's it's been tested and it's gone wrong. Well, actually, wasn't a test meant to test the thing so you can make it better? So it's meant to go wrong, isn't it? You know, so it's all this, like, it's just a really interesting spin on the whole notion of philosophy, technology, and also bringing the whole concept of mindfulness and perfection into it is yeah, like you say, Kim, and is absolutely fascinating. So I can sit here talking to you all day as well.
It sounds like we are both recovering perfectionists.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we all are, most certainly. But you know what you both were sort of talking, what you were all talking about there, really, it's very interesting because, you know, we're all in a state of development, right? Like Google is always being redeveloped. We've got all of these programs that are always continually patching and they're continually redeveloping, adding new features. But also with the AI and actually the way that it's being trained and programmed, when the teams are more diverse, then we are slowly becoming less biased because the teams are actually more diverse. So they are putting different perspectives on things that perhaps originally were just white programmers, you know, guys sitting around drinking coffee and everything else, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is great to think about what is the truthiest truth to solve the problems at hand? And what are our blind spots in that? And by the truthiest truth to solve the problem at hand, it is often the case of things like, okay, how do we define our original parameters to solve this machine learning problem? A lot of people, they want to apply artificial intelligence to every problem that artificial intelligence can be applied to, which is, it's useful, especially if it's useful and it does actually solve the problems that we do want it to solve. But sometimes in defining these parameters at first, for instance, we get the wrong parameters or we realize something later. So one matter in artificial intelligence ethics, for instance, is, well, I was once in a conversation where someone suggested, well, you only store the data for as long as you need it. And then after that, then you delete all of the data. And I told him that that doesn't make very much sense, especially if you are in a technology startup, which doesn't have the funds to recollect all of this data again, if they realize 5 months after they had already deleted it, that there is another parameter that they should have looked at. For example, when it comes to pedestrian behavior prediction, one of the parameters that I came up with a few months into this that wasn't original was the weather, because weather can have effects on how a person moves through their road scene. And it can have effects on what kinds of clothes people wear and the length of clothes and whether their legs might be obscured by, say, a long trench coat or something like that. So then in that case, I think that it is useful a lot of times to store data until we are really quite certain in that we have what we need in terms of the truthiest truths, and that there isn't much or any more that we can do with it, at least for the time.
I love that concept of the truthiest truth, that piece that's saying it's the best truth we can have today based on the information that we've got. It doesn't mean to say it's going to be a perfect truth, because, you know, as we've said earlier, we're perhaps all recovering perfectionists, but we have all grown up, haven't we, with this notion that we should all be perfect. And yet, actually, the truth is we're all perfectly imperfect. It's our imperfection that is our perfection. And I guess the more that we can utilize that in technology, we'll that embracing that difference, the fact that actually our imperfections are what help us get through the bias and create a new view, because we've all got a different imperfection to bring to the party, might hopefully help us also continue to shape that debate, isn't it, and change that label so that we can grow in a less harmful way to ourselves and be more mindful. I just loved that whole concept of giving yourself permission to go with the best that you could do with the information that's available right now, and then know that you can keep going back and evolving and changing, you know, and like learning from it and viewing it from a different parameter, to your point with the data, not just chucking it out because we think we've done it from the first set of parameters and then find, oh, we didn't look at this, or we'd not thought of that, because something changes. And sometimes those changes can be seemingly not important to what you're doing. So, you know, thinking about the weather as an example, when you're looking at people's pedestrian behaviours, wouldn't automatically spring to mind, would you? Think, oh, they're going to walk to school the way they walk to school, they're going to come back the way that they come back. And yet, you know, I know when it's the school run and it's torrential rain, I walk a heck of a lot faster and probably a lot less concentrating on what's around me, and much more concentrating on trying to keep the hood on my head and the hood on my child so we don't get too wet. So it is those parts that say, you know, one external factor can totally change how people react to a normal situation. And it's how we help technology to learn from that, I guess.
Indeed. In a way, we are trying to create a semblance of human intuition through a lot of matters of technology. Well, human intuition in the sense of being correct where possible. Of course, some things that are considered imperfections in one scenario will be considered really strong strengths in others. For example, let's say that a person is very obsessive. That can help them with finding errors in something that would otherwise get them, say, checking their drawer multiple times to make sure that there is enough of a certain utensil there. So I think that when it comes to what a winning mindset is, for instance, it's not a mindset of optimism, but a mindset of optimization in terms of not just finding the best situation, because sometimes you can't assume that the best situation already exists, especially given the differences of all kinds of individuals, but creating states or possibilities, stacking cards in the favor of your mind for setting yourself up for success. So, for example, if we assume that we are completely separate from our environments, then we'll find probably quite soon that we are wrong about that. So that part of this comes through the ways that we organize things within our surroundings. The head priest of my temple would often say, okay, if you're having a bad day, then you should go and clean your room. Or when was the last time you cleaned the restroom? And then after doing some of that organization of things that are outside of us, then inside of us would feel quite a bit better and more organized itself because it's more optimized. So it is adaptive. And I think that part of this story of becoming a good optimist, not one who is so attached to things being perfect, but attached to matters of, okay, how do we grow? And how can we be more correct in the long term, even if we are wrong a lot of times in the short term? That can be useful for thinking through what is, rather than telling ourselves stories that, in a sense, stories are a hypothesis. A lot of them are. And if we can test them, then that can help us find out more about our strengths and what works for us and what doesn't work for us, which may or may not work for someone else.
It's not often I'm lost for words, to be fair. These guys are laughing. Kim was smiling the same as me, because we basically, both of us, like, Kim's just painted her whole house and I've just moved into a brand new place with everything's, well, it was set up completely, but then when everything is perfect, then we look for imperfections. This is what's interesting. Like, the brain just seems to look for these things that are not correct, right? And we have to kind of fix those as well. It's a really funny, funny world we live in. It really is.
I think it's like you said, Sharina, it's that whole part of saying, once you take yourself outside, and, you know, I did go on a bit of a crazy crazy stint. I had something that wasn't working well in my life, and I decided to focus instead on decorating my little girl's bedroom because I couldn't control what was happening. So I was like, well, I'll go and do that. I can do something nice that's external. And it felt so much better. So I then became a one-woman decorating machine that has gone through my entire house and decorated every single room in 3 weeks while still working and managing the Easter holidays. Everyone's like, what are you doing? I was like, but it feels great. It's like to actually just focus on something that's not in my head. It's like tidying things up, getting rid of the clutter, getting rid of the rubbish. And what I found when I got to the end of it, and I literally finished it yesterday, was I feel like my mind's so much freer somehow in kind of spending that time cleaning the external environment within which I live. I've ended up clearing the internal environment with which I live. So I loved that, kind of they were teaching you the same thing, because I hadn't realized I was doing that. And yet inadvertently I have done just that in the last 3 weeks. And you're right, it really does make a difference, doesn't it? It creates the space for you to find what's important.
And sometimes we do create things that are imperfect in our trying to make things as perfect as possible. One story that I like to tell is baking a birthday cake for my sister when she was in high school. We were both in high school. And well, when this cake came out of the oven, it was lopsided. And then I go, well, maybe I can make this better by putting some frosting on it. And maybe people won't notice so much. So then I tried putting frosting on this cake, but you can just imagine that this eventually turns out also very sloppy. So that now there is a sloppy cake with some sloppy wording on it. Happy birthday, Melina. And then I go, oh, now everyone's going to see how terrible this cake is, and it's going to be the worst. My sister comes downstairs, she looks at this cake, and then she bursts out laughing, saying that this is the best cake she's ever had. And then her friends seem to enjoy it very much too, because it's perfectly imperfect. There are very few things that are more charming than a lopsided cake, and especially lopsided cake with sloppy decoration from your older sister who doesn't know how to paint with frosting, apparently. So then the next year I was asked to also decorate her cake. And I realized partway through that I could not put the words "Happy birthday, Melina" on the cake. So it just said, "Happy day, Melina." It was absurd. But the thing is that everyone loved it, because it wasn't something that you could just manufacture and buy. It was a matter of someone who really cared to go the extra frosting or the extra mile in a case.
I love it. Well, it's done with love, wasn't it? It was done with love and care. And I think people really, really appreciate that. You know, when they know that you've taken time, because we can go and buy something, but we didn't have to, yes, we had to part with money, but we didn't really have to part with very much else. Whereas when you stand and make a cake and frost the cake and ice it, and I feel your pain, I cannot write with icing either. I often blame Scarlett. She did it. She's five, poor soul. But it is that piece of saying, actually, I gave you something that was the most precious thing we can give anybody, which is time.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And if you ever need a cake decorator who may be charming but imperfect, then I am here.
Classic. So before you go, Shireen, I wanted to ask you one last question. What excites you most about the where we are with technology right now?
I think the most exciting thing is the matters of helping more people live their best life. I think that technology has allowed people in a lot of countries that wouldn't otherwise have economic opportunities go from having very little to being able to do something that is meaningful with their lives. For example, a lot of software, it can scale to the point where it affects millions of people. And to be able to do that with your work, it is very empowering. I also think that when it comes to matters of accessibility, in terms of people who need medical technology, is also that technology can help humans to stay healthier for longer. This kind of started, the wearable technology revolution, it seems to have mostly started with Fitbit, and then it eventually evolved to more and better devices over time, such that it's normal for us to wear wearables nowadays, and nobody really questions that you know the number of steps that you took, for instance. So I think that having more data and more data in the hands of people who need it and whom it's relevant to, it can help a lot in determining, okay, what is the next thing that I need to do in order to improve or keep things going well? Even though sometimes that feels like we still have to roll our sleeves up and make it a project.
That's fantastic. Very interesting. I'm very interested in the future of jobs and how people can actually, you know, you can predict what jobs are going to be out of fashion in the next few years. And actually you can analyze people's skill sets, behaviors, mindset and everything in order to give them the right kind of educational plan, right? I'm fascinated by that. And we're going to talk about that, I think, over the next few weeks in another interview. But we'd love to interview you again. It'd be super at some point in the next few months, because it's been just fantastically interesting. And I think a lot of people will find this very interesting. So I will put your links wherever this is available, and people can look for you on LinkedIn, I think. So you're Dr. Sharina Rice, PhD, and they can find you if they search for you, right?
Indeed.
Super, super. Well, thank you so much. Did you want to say anything, you ladies, before we scoot off?
Just thank you so much, Sharina. It's been fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to next time.
Yeah, absolutely, Sharina. It was great meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening.
Make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections.
And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen.